Right is only in question between equals in power, while the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. Now that's a quotation from the ancient Greek historian Thucydides, expressing a view of the world, a very bleak view of the world, as one in which the powerful dominate the weaker. And I think that represents, if you like, the core idea in most understandings of imperialism. When people talk about imperialism or empires, they typically mean that the powerful, a situation in which the powerful dominate the weak. And that often goes along with the idea that imperialism has always been with us, that it's a consequence of human nature, or something like that. Now, this is very different from the Marxist theory of imperialism. We've already had a session in this course on that theory, and I'm not going to go over all the ground, but I think it's necessary to start with that theory before looking at what the actual very, in many ways, very strange and unstable developments that are taking place at the present time. For the Marxist theory of imperialism, imperialism is something specific. It's specific to capitalism. It's a particular phase in the development of capitalism. And indeed, the theory itself emerged in a very particular context. The context, the years before the outbreak of the First World War, you know, that splendid event that we're busy celebrating, all the slaughter and butchery that took place, a glorious moment in the history of Europe. In the lead up to the First World War, it was obvious that the major European powers were arming against each other. There was an arms race, there was increasingly tight military alliances taking place. In other words, there was an intensification of what in the kind of academic trade that I'm involved in is called geopolitical competition, the rivalries between states. And the starting point of the classical Marxist theory of imperialism was how to explain this this intensification of geopolitical competition. And I think the most useful way of thinking about imperialism, modern capitalist imperialism, is that it involves the intersection or fusion of economic and geopolitical competition. Economic competition is, of course, the driving force of capitalism. Capital, Marx says, can only exist as many capitals. The capitalist class are inherently fragmented, they're hostile brothers, as Marx also said, and the competitive struggle among rival capitals drives the whole process of accumulation and crisis, which is the history of capitalism, if you but what you get at the beginning of the 20th century is the fusion of economic and geopolitical competition. Not that geopolitical competition is anything new. Thucydides, in his History of the Peloponnesian War, written at the beginning of the 5th century BC, is analysing the brutal and intense rivalries among the Greek city-states of that era. So geopolitical competition is something that has existed for, I don't know, several thousand years in one form or another in different regions of the world. But what we get with the rise of modern capitalist imperialism is the integration and subordination of geopolitical competition among states to the logic of competition and accumulation that is the driving force of capitalism. Now, this is it. Why I stress the importance of geopolitical competition is because there are people on the left who say that geopolitical competition isn't a feature of the contemporary world. For example, Tony Negri, the celebrated Italian Marxist, in the book he wrote with Michael Hart, Empire, says imperialism is over, and it's over because geopolitical competition is over. On this basis, Negri has been a very strong supporter of the European Union, but which he sees as transcending the old, obsolete nation state and its rivalries and so on and so forth. And in the debates that we've had, and probably are going to continue to have a while over Brexit, one of the major issues has been, doesn't the European Union represent the transcendence of the nation state, a move towards a transnational form of capitalism and all that kind of thing. Now, these issues, these were hot issues 100 years ago. You'll find, for example, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Kautsky, two of the leading Marxist theorists in the strongest party of the Second International, the German Social Democratic Party, arguing over European integration, with Kautsky saying, this is European integration will develop as part of capital's movement beyond the nation state, capital's moving to a transnational phase, and Rosa Luxemburg saying some extremely uncomplimentary things about European integration and what it would actually represent. She'd be getting a lot of dislikes on Facebook. But I want to focus on Lenin in this context, because Lenin's formulation of the theory of imperialism was much the most politically important. So what Lenin did was to argue two things. First of all, to insist that imperialism had to be understood as a specific phase of capitalist development. You know, this is summed up by the title of his famous pamphlet, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. And what he essentially argues is that the accumulation process leads to greater and greater what Marx called concentration and centralization of capital. In other words, individual firms get bigger, and also they get fewer, so that sectors and whole economies are dominated by a handful of large firms. And critically, imperialism is a consequence of this structural transformation of capitalism. Lenin said, imperialism is the monopoly stage of capitalism. It reflects this great economic concentration. The second idea, and this is, other people had said versions of the same thing as Lenin said about the concentration and centralization of capital. But the second thing that he said is his real originality, which is the idea of uneven development. In other words, capitalism develops into a global system. Lenin had a very, very good sense of this, because he, as in his early days as a revolutionary, was trying to make sense of how capitalism was kind of incorporating and transforming his own society, Russia. So imperialism develops as a global system, but it doesn't so in a uniform way. It does so in a highly uneven way. So you get concentrations of economic power in particular regions of the globe, and that concentration of economic power leads to the advanced sections of capitalism dominating the rest of the world. That's the explanation for the, if you like, common sense understanding of imperialism, the powerful, in the sense of the capitalist powerful, dominating the weak, the rest. But crucially, as capitalism develops, the concentrations, the regional concentrations of capitalist power shift. So Lenin takes on Kautsky, who anticipated Negri's argument. Kautsky puts forward the theory of ultra-imperialism. In other words, the idea that capitalism has reached a stage where its organization is bursting beyond national boundaries. This is the logical culmination, if you like, of the concentration of centralization of capital. And this means different capitals will be integrated into a transnational entity, and war among capitalists will become irrational. So Kautsky's reaction to the First World War was, this is a kind of transitional phase. You know, close your eyes and hope, and you know, things will be better in the future. The League of Nations, which emerged after the end of the First World War, represents this increasing transnational organization of capitalism. And Lenin said, this is completely wrong. And it's completely wrong because of uneven development, because the center of capitalist power is shifting all the time. He says, 50 years ago, Germany was a miserable backward country, and Britain was the dominant industrial capitalist society. Now, look at what's happened with Germany. Germany is the, by then, the second biggest industrial economy in the world. It's challenging British dominance in all sorts of dimensions. And that shift in the distribution of economic power, which is a feature of uneven development, is what's producing the conflict that produces the First World War, and indeed, although Lenin didn't live to see it, the Second World War as well. And this continuous process of uneven development and shifts in the centre of capitalist power make ultra-imperialism possible. Because ultra-imperialism presupposes a stable distribution of power that can underpin whatever deals are made by the different capitalist classes. But the development of capitalism will constantly disrupt that. Now, when we apply this approach to imperialism to the contemporary world, what do we see? Can it really be said that imperialism is over in the way that people like Arthur Negri argued? At the end of the Cold War, 25 or so years ago, it seemed indeed as if, well, people on the left vacillated. They either said imperialism is over, in the sense that Arthur Negri argued, a contemporary version of Kautsky's idea of ultra-imperialism. You have the emergence of empire as a kind of transnational capitalist form of power that represents the end of inter-imperialist rivalries and so on. Or you had the idea that not imperialism is over, but now you have a single imperialist power, the US, that dominates all the other capitalist powers and is unchallengeable. And this is articulated by people on the left, I have to say in a much more sophisticated and interesting way than Negri, by, for example, Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin in their book, The Making of Global Capitalism, which got the Deutsche Prize a few years ago. It seems to me that both those arguments are clearly can't stand up to any serious empirical analysis. If we look at what's happening at the present time, what do we see? We see in the seas off the coast of China increasing geopolitical competition. In the South China Sea, which China claims on the basis of a map that was produced by the Chinese government, the nationalist Chinese government, the Kuomintang government, I think from the 1930s, China claims the whole of the South China Sea. This is an important area because there are all sorts of energy reserves there and so on. Lots of other states in the area claim it as what we claim some of these islands, the Philippines, Vietnam, and so on and so forth. The Chinese state is in the process of consolidating its claim to some of these islands by hugely extending them, by, if you like, building on to particular fragments, little islands, turning them into much bigger entities, partly to strengthen its legal claim, for reasons I don't really understand to do with international law, but also for more practical reasons. You know, if you build on the islands, then you can airstrips, helicopter pads, missile bases, etc. A bit further north, you have the conflict between China and Japan over islands which are called either Senkaku or Daoyu. My apologies to anyone from China and Japan here for my pronunciation, which involve, Chinese and Japanese warplanes, you know, flying very close to each other or buzzing each other's ships and things like that. Let's remember what we're talking about. The Asia-Pacific region is now the site of the most dynamic zone of global capitalism. China today is the second biggest economy in the world. This is a conflict that pits the second biggest economy in the world, China, against the third biggest economy in the world, namely Japan. And it also involves the first biggest economy in the world, namely the United States, because the US has a security treaty with Japan, and the strategic alliance between the US and Japan is very, very important. So what we have are what are supposed to be old-style, you know, obsolete territorial disputes. We have serious territorial disputes involving the biggest capitalist states in the world in probably what is now the key zone of global capitalism. That looks to me like imperialism. That looks to me like geopolitical competition, potentially on a very large scale indeed. Then, of course, look what's happened in Europe in the past few years. Part of the bullshit of the EU has been that we are a new kind of power. We are a normative power. In other words, we rule, we exert our influence by values. In other words, we're not like the nasty Americans who, you know, go around invading and bombing. We're the friendly Western power. And on that basis, the EU, tell that to the Greeks, of course. But on that basis, the EU has been pushing eastwards, and the EU made an attempt to incorporate Ukraine. And as we know, the reaction of Russia under Putin was to prevent that happening through seizing Crimea, backing different pro-Russian groups in eastern Ukraine, precipitating a very horrible and destructive civil war, and so on and so forth. But although the conflict in Ukraine itself has to a significant degree stabilized, what we're seeing is more geopolitical and military maneuvering. The US has been cutting down massively its forces in Europe. Now it's increasing significantly its defense spending. Now it's committed itself to deploying an armored brigade to Eastern Europe. So we're talking about, again, what looks like quite serious geopolitical conflict taking place. Now, when we see these phenomena, what they are fundamentally is a consequence of the relative economic decline of the United States. In other words, we have to go back to Lenin's understanding of uneven development. The process of uneven development goes on remorselessly as long as capitalism exists. And this has led, crucially, to the industrialization of significant parts of East Asia, and decisively, as part of that process, the rise of China. China is the biggest industrial economy in the world. It's the biggest exporting economy in the world. It's the biggest consumer of energy in the world. It's now the biggest producer of CO2 emissions. You know, it's in certain areas, by no means completely, it is putting itself in the same kind of category as the United States, and this involves not just a shift in economic power, but it gives the Chinese ruling class the confidence and the resources to begin to assert themselves geopolitically, to build up their military power, to throw their weight out. A weight around in the Asia-Pacific region, and in all sorts of ways to challenge American domination. In particular, there is significant naval competition between the US and China. China is building up a fleet, which is crucial to contesting US dominance of the Pacific region, because since the Second World War, the US Navy has dominated the Pacific. Having destroyed Japanese military power during the Second World War, the US has been overwhelmingly the dominant power in the Pacific. Now that position is being challenged. And this weakening of American imperialism isn't just a consequence of, if you like, long-term impersonal economic mechanisms and how that is reflected in the strategies of different states. It's been reinforced by something that we're being reminded of a lot at the minute because of the forthcoming Chilcot inquiry, by the war in Iraq. Because the war in Iraq was an attempt by the Bush administration, loyally, you know, served by their gallant ally Tony Blair and to all his bag carriers who are still in the House of Commons, to consolidate American domination of the Middle East, grab Iraq, strengthen US control of the Middle East, and use that control to discipline all the other powers who are much more dependent on the energy of the Middle East than the US itself is. And that's even more true now because of because the fracking revolution in the US means that the US is increasingly itself self-sufficient in energy. Anyway, that attempt failed. It failed catastrophically. And it's very important to underline this because the people on the left who say, okay, there was an insurgency and all that kind of thing, but still American corporations made a lot of money out of Iraq, you know. It really was, you know, the US wasn't defeated in Iraq. I'm sorry, I don't know what evidence you need to acknowledge the extent of the US defeated in Iraq. Surely the rise of ISIS. Surely ISIS's seizure of the second biggest city in Iraq does count as evidence of the extent of the Americans' failure in Iraq. And I think it's important to underline this was a bigger defeat in Vietnam. I've been thinking a lot about Vietnam because I happened to read a novel that was partly about someone's experience of the Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive, and brought the whole thing back to me. This was such a spectacular defeat for American imperialism, this national liberation movement that stood up to all the pounding that the American military could throw at it, and in the end forced the Americans out and overturned their puppet regime and so on. But that wasn't as bad a defeat as the one that the US suffered in Iraq. Because President Eisenhower justified the US being in Vietnam by what was called the domino theory. In other words, you knock down one domino, Vietnam, and then all the other dominoes, all the other Asian powers will fall. Not true at all. The US was able to contain the defeat in Vietnam, partly because it made an opportunistic alliance with China against the Soviet Union when Nixon went to Beijing in 1972, partly because of the support that it gave to dynamic East Asian economies like South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan. So the blow to American dominance represented by the Vietnam War was symbolically very great, but materially not that great. Take a look at the Middle East. A bit different there, isn't it? When you look at the way in which the combination of the defeat in the defeat in Iraq and the Arab uprisings have destabilized the whole region, spread chaos to the whole region, with in turn, of course, the effects that we know in terms of the flight of refugees to Europe and so on and so forth. This is a much bigger defeat. So we have to see, to understand the weakening of the United States, the combination of long-term economic changes and how that is it represented in shifts in state policy with the effect of political struggles and political events. Now, let's look a bit at what particular powers are doing. If we look at Russia, what is Russia trying to do? Russia is partly simply fighting to hang on to the remnants of some imperial influence. And that is reflected both in Ukraine, the intervention in Ukraine to stop Ukraine being fully integrated in the so-called Euro-Atlantic community, which means not just the EU but NATO. It's the package deal which was delivered to Eastern and Central Europe around the beginning of the present century that the Russians wanted to stop. But similarly, the Russians are intervening in Syria in part in order to, because Syria has been a long-term ally of Moscow, going back to the 1950s. But it's also interesting to see that China and Russia are drawing significantly closer. I mean, China and Russia fought a war at the end of the 1970s. This reflected the success of Kissinger and Nixon's tactic of trying to develop an alliance with China. A bit in those days, you know, under Maoist leadership and all that, very anti-imperialist himself, developing an alliance with China in order to isolate and weaken the Soviet Union and its bloc. Now we see, although the Chinese sometimes have tried to keep Russia at a distance, they're quite interesting signs of cooperation. The beginning of June, within the space of a couple of days, first, I think it was first a Russian And then a Chinese warship sailed very close to the islands that are disputed with Japan. Is it just a coincidence that these shows of naval force were made by both those powers at the same time? And more or less simultaneously, the Chinese and Russian military have been engaging in war games together. This is an interesting shift. Doesn't mean that there's an alliance between Russia and China against the United States. Definitely doesn't mean that they intend to go to war against the United States or anything like that. So it's a lot of alarmist nonsense, you know, because some Russian fighters buzz British ships, therefore, you know, the Russians are coming or anything like that. We're talking about maneuvers in the literal sense that Russia and China are trying to create a more favorable balance of forces for themselves on a global basis. But nevertheless, the degree of cooperation that is developing is really, really quite interesting. In response to this, the Obama administration is carrying through the famous tilt to Asia. In other words, it's concentrating on trying to contain the rise of China. Critically, partly by moving American military assets to the Asia-Pacific region, but also through a policy of divide and rule, playing on the fears of other states of the US. So I talked about the Vietnam War. Who is potentially one major US ally against China in the Asia-Pacific region? It's Vietnam. There have been discussions about, I mean, it's really corrupt. There's this base, Cameran Bay, which the Americans built during the Vietnam War to service their war effort. Then they lost it, of course, when they lost the war. And Russia, the Soviet Union, used the base. That doesn't happen anymore. No, there's the beginning of negotiations between the Americans and the Vietnamese about the US using Cameran Bay. So that's an indication of the kind of maneuvers that the US is making, playing on the fears of other states in the region of Chinese self-assertiveness in order to isolate China. Not so easy, because the economic links with China are so strong and are growing, and also because even the Vietnamese, who beat China humiliatingly in the war in 1979, are nervous about antagonizing Beijing too much. And Obama is very consistent in trying to pursue this strategy. I mean, he gave a very interesting interview a few months ago in which he underlined what a waste of space, from the point of view of American strategy, he thought the Middle East was. And he even disparaged the war on terror, even though he's still using drones to assassinate people. He said more people are killed in their baths in the United States than are killed by terrorism. He was trying to play down the war on terror, because I think he wants to stop drone killings and things like that, but he wants to concentrate US efforts on the real long-term threats to US power, which particularly come from China. But the problem is, he constantly gets dragged back. He's been forced, as I've said, to deploy more resources to deal with the Russians. And let me say, Brexit is a complicating factor in all this, because the US relies on Britain as its key European ally to try and brigade together the other Europeans to increase military spending and deploy troops to Eastern and Central Europe. And, you know, the Brexit, at least in the short term, throws a big spanner into the works. He's also, I think, in some ways more importantly, being dragged back in the Middle East. The US would prefer to deal with problems in the Middle East through divide and rule. In other words, use powers like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia, like Iran, which Obama has drawn the US closer to, like Israel, use them as the fire brigade to deal with the problems. But also play play them off against each other, they've been only successful to a very limited extent in doing this. Or rather, ISIS has really made, the rise of ISIS has undermined this strategy, because what you see is, you know, we're told here ISIS is the great enemy, we have to destroy ISIS, etc., etc. If you look at most of the regional powers, they're not particularly worried about ISIS. They're much more interested in Syria, in particular, in their side winning in that war, than they are worried about ISIS, and they can have tactical alliances with ISIS and so on and so forth. So the US is, you see the US slowly deploying more and more forces to Iraq and Syria. Not just air power, special forces. In other words, elite fighting groups who are beginning to take casualties. Now, of course, they're there to advise the Iraqi army. God knows who they're advising in Syria. But to advise the Iraqi army. But again, go back to Vietnam. How did the US military deployment in Vietnam start? With advisors, with special forces. So, and the pressure from the Pentagon is to deploy more forces there. If Clinton wins the presidential election, almost certainly the Pentagon won't get everything that it wants, but it'll get more than it's wanted from a partner. So the US is grappling with a series of different crises, trying to spread its resources between them. The plight of the US today more and more reminds me of Britain between the two world wars. Britain was then still the biggest imperialist power. Its empire actually increased after the First World War because it grabbed chunks of the Middle East and so on. But it was confronted with a series of challenges in different parts of the world. Obviously, after Hitler came to power, Germany in Europe, Italy in the Mediterranean, Japan in Asia, and Britain just found it really hard to find enough resources to deal with all those different threats. This is the kind of the position that the US is in today. Now, this is a dangerous situation. Remember the moment when Turkey shot down a Russian plane. That's the first military action between Russia and a NATO member state since NATO was founded in 1949. Interestingly, Erdogan, the Turkish ruler, is in such a dodgy position that he's just apologized to Russia for shooting down the plane. But nevertheless, that was a very scary moment. It illustrates the extent to which even the biggest powers aren't really in control of the situation, particularly in the Middle East, but potentially on a global scale as well. This underlines the Marxist critique of imperialism. And that critique involves understanding that imperialism is a system. It's not just one big bully dominating the rest of the world. You know, in other words, it's not just about the dominance of the United States. What we have is a system of rival capitalist imperialist states struggling for domination against each other and producing crises that potentially can escape their control with devastating consequences for people in the area or on a much larger scale. We see the devastating consequences in the Middle East, the mass suffering, the deaths, the refugees, the horrible suffering of the people of Fallujah who've been supposedly saved from ISIS by the Iraqi government forces and now are suffering all sorts of dreadful things. This is a very dangerous system. We need to build an anti-war movement. We need to rebuild the anti-war movement of 10 years ago against the war drive, particularly of the Western powers, and we need to do that in a way that doesn't involve taking side between the different imperialist powers. The main difference between Putin and Obama is not that Putin is nicer than Obama or vice versa. The main difference is that Putin is weaker than Obama. But he represents the same kind of imperialist drive as the United States does. The problem is the system. And therefore, we need to build an anti-war movement against these different rulers, but we need much more than that. We need the development of a strong revolutionary left around the world that can lead the kind of struggle that Lenin and Luxembourg talked about 100 years ago. In other words, a movement that isn't against a particular war, but is about destroying the system that breeds these wars in the first place.